For Wednesday, February 2nd, 2005. Good afternoon. We are continuing with a presentation from the Department of Justice, House Bill 5044. And today on our agenda, members, we have four presentations, starting with the Criminal Division, Mr. Stephen Briggs, followed by the Crime Victims Assistance Division or Department, and that will be presented by Connie Gallagher. Trial Division, presented by Tim Wood, and then the Appellate Division and Defense of Criminal Convictions, and that's time permitting. And Mary Williams will be bringing that presentation to us. Good afternoon.
Chair Gordley, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Briggs. I'm the Chief Counsel for the Criminal Justice Division, and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon about our program. Dive right into it. The Criminal Justice Division is relatively small in the law enforcement community, but we are, to my knowledge, the only full-service law enforcement agency in the state. And by that I mean we do everything from investigations, prosecutions, and criminal intelligence and analysis. Our primary function is to provide support and assistance to others in the law enforcement community throughout the state because of the size that we have. Here's a chart of our organization. We are broken into three separate sections: the District Attorney Assistant Section, the Organized Crime Section, and then the Crime Victims Assistance Section. I will focus my comments on the DA Assist and Organized Crime Sections, and Ms. Gallagher will address the Crime Victims Section when I'm through. Also on this chart you see the Western States Information Network. That is a network of five states in the western United States that coordinate the sharing of intelligence and information: California, Washington, Alaska, Hawaii, and Oregon. This pie chart shows the governor's recommended budget for the Department of Justice and our share of that. This one piece of the pie represents the Criminal Justice Division, and that is further subdivided between crime victims and the DA Assist and Organized Crime Section. And you'll see there that the DA Assist and Organized Crime Section accounts for approximately $17 million. This is a map of Oregon that shows the counties in which we had conducted investigations or prosecutions in the last biennium. And it covers pretty much all the state other than Tillamook or Wheeler County, which we have worked in the past, but not this last biennium. A number of these counties we have conducted numerous investigations. This chart here shows open and active cases comparing the last biennium to the current biennium. This is projected through the completion of our current biennium. It shows pretty much consistent numbers of cases with an increase in our organized crime cases that we've worked, not only the number but also the complexity. We've tackled a number of more complex racketeering type investigations in the last biennium.
Mr. Briggs, before you go on, in the open and active cases,
I appreciate
that. The number 181, that's a projection.
Correct.
Could you talk about the assumptions leading to that projection?
My recollection is that that's based on the prior 18 months of the biennium and what we anticipated with the level of growth that we had seen through those 18 months, what the continued level of growth would be through the full biennium for the next 6 months.
I see. Members, I would also note for the record that we now have a quorum with the presence of Senator Winters. Please continue.
This reflects our performance measure, the Criminal Justice Division. Cases resolved successfully. Our target was 98%. We achieved 96%. My understanding of what that means, cases resolved successfully, is either the conviction was achieved or we undertook an investigation and decided that there was no basis for criminal charges. So essentially this reflects whether we exercise good judgment in our decision making with regard to cases.
Mr. Briggs, could you tell the committee how the target is set? Again, what are your assumptions?
Chair Gordley, I believe the target was based upon what we achieved in the last biennium. I'm not exactly sure what the target is based upon.
Who would have that information?
I don't know, but I can find that out for you.
Okay. And just so that the department is aware, as we continue our discussion about the performance measures, we're going to want to be very clear about how the targets have been established. So please continue.
Thank you. I'll begin with our district attorney assistance section. This was created about 40 years ago, and it encompasses five different areas of expertise. First and foremost, we do trial work, assisting district attorneys, conduct investigations, training publications, and then separately we do election law investigations and prosecutions as well.
Chair Gordon.
Representative Hanna.
Can you help us understand, when you do trial assistance at the county level with district attorneys, is there a remuneration back and forth? How does that, do the counties pay for those services from you? How does that work?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hanna, they do not pay us for those services. Those are services that we provide to them generally.
Can I follow up? So is that part of the 181 and the mentioned cases? Is that some of that casework?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hanna, that's correct. It's a slice of it. Then there's the organized crime cases as well added together.
Please continue.
As you see, we do the majority of our trial assistance for district attorneys is in the small to medium-sized counties. The five largest counties in Oregon generally have large enough prosecution units that they don't need our assistance, and they have the expertise on particular matters that they don't need our assistance. But there are 17 counties in Oregon with five or fewer prosecutors, and if they have a especially complex case, such as an aggravated murder or maybe a multi-jurisdictional drug case, cases such as that, they will call upon us and ask for our assistance. A couple of examples of the cases that we might work. You might remember the Christian Longo murder case over in Lincoln County. We assisted the Lincoln County District Attorney on that. At the same time, we were assisting on an aggravated murder in Curry County in Gold Beach. There was another example was three gentlemen attempted to burn down the house of the chief deputy district attorney in Crook County, and they asked for our assistance to prosecute those gentlemen as well. Those are examples of how we might assist a district attorney. I would also mention that on occasion the governor asks the attorney general to assume the role of running a district attorney's office when maybe you have a district attorney who resigns or might be impeached or you have a death or other circumstances, and the attorney general will delegate to our division the responsibility for doing that. And in my tenure in the criminal justice division, we've done that on a number of occasions. Within our district attorney assistance section, we have four attorneys, and we also have two detectives that provide assistance assist local law enforcement and homicide investigations. We also have three financial investigators technically assigned to our organized crime section, but we're finding more and more that district attorneys need assistance on complex cases involving embezzlement, financial crimes, especially with regard to senior citizens, and that, to my knowledge, Portland Police Bureau is the only law enforcement agency that has another financial investigator, and they just have one, and we have three. And it's been a growth business for us, to say the least. The District Attorney Assistance Section is also responsible for conducting training for prosecutors in the state. We conduct an annual institute for basic, for new prosecutors, approximately 20 to 25. It's an intensive week-long course where we cover things such as trial practice skills, as well as procedural rules, ethics. For example, we might instruct, we might talk about the correct procedures for running a grand jury, or we might talk about the rules for handling methamphetamine or dangerous chemicals within a courtroom, that type of training. We also do an advanced training institute for senior prosecutors within the state. Another response...
Mr. Briggs, before you go forward, is any of that training done in cooperation with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training? Are there any issues that cross over?
We do some training with DPSST, but not for the prosecutors. We do other training for law enforcement in coordination with Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Okay.
Another part of what we do is publications. I think this is a real significant program that we have, and here's an example of one thing that we do. It's called the Search and Seizure Manual. We try to put it out annually. Last year, for the first time, we were not able to do it because of workload. But what this book contains summaries of significant case law in Oregon dealing with search and seizure law, which is the primary issue that prosecutors face in motions practice. And so prosecutors throughout the state and police officers have an excellent resource to know what to do when they're conducting searches and seizures or when they're defending them in court. And this means that the prosecutors throughout the state are doing a better job in court. Police officers are less likely to engage in conduct that would be inappropriate. And our appellate staff is going to be faced with less issues involving improper searches and seizures, hopefully because people are doing the right thing as a result of this resource. Another publication that we put out is our indictment form book. And every time a new law is passed, if prosecutors want to charge it, they have to come up with language to put into the indictment. And so we have tried to make that a uniform practice within the state by coming up with uniform language to put into indictments. And that's another benefit that we provide to district attorneys in the state. One more thing that I should mention about our DA assist section. We also provide assistance to the Secretary of State's office in investigating and prosecuting election law violations when they request to do that. And we have, I believe, approximately 160 inquiries going on at this point at various stages. And that could be anything from false signatures on initiative petitions, which is the majority of what we do, including people who may vote twice on ballots through the mail, that type of thing.
How do you interface with government standards and practices? Because they also have a role when you talk about complaint filing, particularly with irregularity with elected officials.
Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, we work fairly closely with them. Whenever we are asked to conduct a public corruption investigation, which I'll talk about in a minute when I talk about organized crime, I stay in contact with the investigator, with them, and sometimes we coordinate, and he will hold off on doing his investigations until we have concluded our fact-finding and made determinations. So that's been an important part of what we've done over the last couple of years, is to make sure that we're not duplicating efforts and that we're able to benefit from one another's work. If I could briefly talk about our organized crime section now. This was a creation of statute back in 1977, and there were five statutory directives, and those are set forth in this slide. And as Senator Winters mentioned, obviously an important part of what we do is investigate allegations of public corruption. Frequently, we will be asked by a district attorney or a law enforcement agency to look at somebody when there's been an allegation, and maybe the DA or the police officer or the sheriff or the chief would at least have an appearance of a conflict, and we're asked to come in and do an inquiry in those circumstances. I think it's significant to note that the majority of our investigations conclude that there is no basis for criminal charges, and we consider that an important part of what we do. Whether we file charges or whether we clear somebody from charges, either way, we think that's an important part. And that's why that's reflected in our performance rating, when we include not just charges filed, but sometimes investigations where people are cleared.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Briggs, define official. You investigate official corruption. Is that Would that be anyone employed by the state of Oregon?
It would be. It would be any person who meets the statutory definition of a public official. And that can be even someone who's not employed but maybe working as a volunteer on a commission.
Say, do we follow up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
To follow up, are there laws on the books that address crime by state employees? You know, do you lose your retirement? Do you lose your job immediately?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, the laws on the books, there are a number of laws that might apply. The more general law would be official misconduct in the first degree or second degree. The sanctions in the statute don't specifically deal with questions of retirement benefits. That would be something separate, would be a relation between the employer and the employee. The sentence that would be imposed by the court would be jail time, financial penalties, that sort of thing. A typical sentence.
Please continue.
If the person is working for the state in the conduct of his business, he's stealing from the state, why would he be earning PERS benefits during that time?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, that would be a question for policymakers on what should be the appropriate sentence. To my knowledge, there is no specific criminal statute that would hold some, that would remove those PERS benefits from that person. Although I am aware that PERS benefits can be attached for restitution purposes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The organized crime section, I talked about the public corruption focus of what we do. There's also a number of other types of cases that we work. Large-scale organized crime investigations, and I could give you a couple examples. I think that may be a better way to illustrate what we do. For example, I can talk in generalities about a case in Washington County. We're assisting the district attorney and the Oregon State Police where several businesses were involved in obtaining allegedly false documents for illegal immigrants into the United States from California and from New York. We are working a racketeering case that we've indicted in Marion County involving the illegal catching and distribution of endangered sturgeon. A large-scale real estate fraud in Yamhill County where close to 100 Mexican immigrants were defrauded. Several cases such as that, we have large-scale investigations going on where we can bring our financial and our other expertise to bear.
Mr. Briggs, what is your level of concern about the presence of organized crime in Oregon overall?
Chair Gordley, I think we must have a continuing, ongoing concern about the presence of organized crime. You can look at any moment in time and comment on its particular status, but that could change in a week.
I guess what I'm asking is, if we're looking at trends over the last 10 years, where are we? Are we improving? Are there hot spots, areas that we should be more concerned about than others? I guess I'm asking you on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your level of concern about where we are as a state and compared to what is going on in other states?
Sure, Gordley. From my travels around the country, I would say that we are doing better than many states in the country, especially high population states on the East Coast. And yet we do have some significant issues, and I will talk in a minute about our tobacco tax enforcement program. And whenever you're talking about large sums of money, you have to be particularly concerned about organized crime. So that could be when you're talking about tax revenue, illicit products, drugs, gambling. Those types of areas are traditionally where organized crime tends to go, and that's been our experience.
Okay. I'm asking you to tell us what we should be paying attention to. That's basically the question.
Sure. Chair Gordley, I would say we should be paying attention to those traditional areas. You're talking about drugs, tobacco, gambling. Those are significant areas where organized crime tends to be involved, and that's where they are involved in Oregon.
Okay, please continue. Senator Winters.
Madam Chair, have you seen over the past 10 years, given, you know, our expansion of casinos and our whole gambling environment in Oregon, have you seen or do you know of an increase in organized crime in that particular area? And also along to I need to go back on in time. In tobacco, particularly if you're talking about the stamps and what have you, at one time in my life I used to work for a company in New York that actually they were a tobacco confectionery company, and I worked in their office, and they put manually the stamps on, which made it vulnerable, if you will, for theft and what have you for sale, because they're sold in these huge bets and thousands of dollars. I don't think we use that process in Oregon in order to tax cigarettes. Am I correct? To put the stamps...
We still stamp cigarettes in Oregon.
Stamp cigarettes. Well, is there a criminal element going on in that particular industry?
Chair Gordley, Senator Winters, yes, there is. And I have a slide later on talking about our efforts in the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, but we're seeing a significant level of organized criminal activity within the sphere of tobacco tax in Oregon. One other item I wanted to mention within the sphere of organized crime section is Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We assist them, provide legal advice, and assist them in decertification of police officers, firemen, security guards. We've seen an increase in the number of those cases and also in the complexity. People who are being subject to decertification are more frequently bringing union representatives or lawyers with them, and they're extending the length of those hearings. And as Senator Winters mentioned, I wanted to briefly touch on our Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. This is a joint effort between ourselves, the Department of Revenue, and the Oregon State Police. It was created by the legislature in 2001 and enhanced in 2003. And we've had some significant successes in the law enforcement sphere. Just within the last 2 months, we've achieved 2 racketeering convictions, which resulted in judgments of approximately $2.4 million. I should point out that one of those judgments we're confident we will probably come close to fully collecting on, around $1.4. The other judgment, we think all the money has been spent, and we're not likely to get much out of that. The task force seeing 2 areas of significant criminal involvement. One is internet sales of cigarettes, which means they're selling cigarettes into the state of Oregon without buying tax stamps and affixing tax stamps. And the other area is other tobacco products, such as chewing tobacco, where stamps are not affixed, and essentially we're relying upon the good faith of people to pay their tax, which is 65% of the wholesale value of the product. I can tell you that we're having significant success with regard to the internet just in the last several months by indicting 2 internet distributors of tobacco products, and through the Attorney General's leadership, we are actually moving towards cooperative agreements with third-party facilitators like credit card companies and shippers to encourage them to stop facilitating the distribution of these products. So we think we're making good progress in that. I should tell you also that the governor's recommended budget is moving back to the levels created by the legislature in 2001. We have a very modest proposal that I believe in another forum we want to talk about how we might maintain some of the cases that we're working on now and hopefully avoid having to abandon those. But we have seen significant organized crime within the sphere of tobacco in Oregon. Briefly touch on a couple other things. Within the last several months, we've begun a new program, the Internet Crimes Against Children program. This is funded through a state grant, and we have an investigator and a computer forensics person who are devoted to identifying distributors of child pornography in Oregon and then conducting investigations and prosecutions of those people. We've had some real success just in the short period of time we've been in business, and we're finding this to be an excellent program. We were surprised to learn that we are really the only ones in the state that have devoted people full-time to this. And time precludes me from telling you about exactly specifically what we're doing, but we're really excited about this program and the success we're having.
Are there federal funds available?
That is what is funding this program, approximately a grant for $300,000 renewed every 18 months.
All right. I misunderstood. your comment.
At some point, I would like to have some outcome, because you said there's some successes without being specific, but those successes as to how many prosecutions and, you know, really what is taking place in this arena. Because it's, in fact, this morning on TV, I believe it was Katie Couric, and there's been some more attention that's being drawn to this issue nationally, and it's one that you know, I'm concerned about. So I would like to know, you know, as we go along, you know, what the results are.
I can give you an example very briefly of a case that we just concluded investigating. It's out of Portland, where we were able to identify, through the assistance of an internet service provider, we identified a person who was distributing child pornography, conducted a search warrant, seized his computers, did a forensic analysis, and determined a large number of child pornography images that are being distributed throughout the country. And so we were able to work. And there were children present in the home, and that's a successful case, in my opinion, even though we haven't yet concluded a prosecution on it. I should also say that it's a very small program involving two people, and the only way we're going to succeed is by reaching out to law enforcement throughout the state and developing partnerships with them, because two people cannot do it by themselves. Another part of our organized crime section is the Cooperative Disabilities Unit. We have two detectives assigned to this operation, and they are, again, funded through the federal government, and their job is essentially to investigate Social Security fraud. And within this biennium, they're projected to have saved the Social Security Administration $21 million through their investigations. And a side benefit for the state of Oregon is that, because Social Security is also often the gateway to the Oregon Health Plan, we're able to cut people off engaged in fraud with regard to the Oregon Health Plan, too. And so they've projected that at approximately $7 million in savings.
Senator Winters.
Madam Chair, Colorado is claiming that they probably are doing more in fraud investigation and saving money than I read an article just recently than all the other states, and I didn't think that was true, because I think we were probably just as aggressive as Colorado in going after some of those cases. So I'm interested in a comparison between Oregon and Colorado, by the way.
Chair Corley, Senator Winters, I can tell you that our unit just received a national award for their efforts. And so we're pretty proud of the work that they're doing.
If you get that to me, I'll send it to the national publication who highlighted Colorado and say that, you know, Oregon is right up there.
We'll do that.
And congratulations on your efforts.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Not to diminish what Colorado's doing, but I...
Another significant part of our organized crime operation is our criminal intelligence unit. And there's several components to that that I'll briefly touch on. One is the Oregon State Intelligence Network, which is a new creation. It's in the last 2 years. It's a web-based criminal intelligence network that connects law enforcement statewide. And we have over 800 law enforcement officers that we've trained in its use. And essentially, an example might help illustrate what it does. If you had a fraud investigator in Portland working an individual, and he were to submit that name into the database, he might find out that a Yamhill County drug task force is working that same individual. And what this network does is put police officers together. And before the creation of OSIM, there was no real comprehensive, efficient system for doing that. And we've seen, in 2 years, we've seen real explosion in its use. An example would be that I believe in the last year we had 1,200 submissions to the network and 800 inquiries with a hit rate of about 13%, which is we find significant.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Briggs, I hope that I'm impressed by that, and I hope some way you're working with the Oregon Office of Homeland Security so that information, they don't have to come out and duplicate that system, or y'all can piggyback or some way work together as we develop our Oregon Office of Homeland Security. Are you doing anything with them? Or?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, yes, we are. As a matter of fact, one of the other items that I wanted to briefly touch on are our efforts with regard to Homeland Security and intelligence in that area. Thank you.
Okay.
Briefly mention the high-intensity drug trafficking area federal initiative. That has provided a small amount of funds for us to assist drug investigation units in the state and provide analytical services for those units. I'll talk about that briefly in a minute. And also the Western States Information Network has provided a couple coordinators and an analyst for us to do additional work with regard to drug interdiction. Our analytical services, most people do not know what a criminal analyst does, and if I could just very briefly touch on that for you, and then I'll talk about our terrorism efforts as well. Here's an example of a link chart that was produced by a criminal analyst. And analysts frequently will take complex information and try to break it down and make it usable for police officers, who often don't have the time to do that. That could include going through telephone toll records, cell tower information, power records, or a number of police reports from different agencies. So they might produce a timeline or a link chart such as this, which connects different parties together, which helps to make an organized crime case. So instead of just prosecuting one person, you can prosecute the whole organization. An example of an analyst that had some real success for us recently was a home invasion robbery in Washington County, where a bunch of persons were pretending to be police officers. And there were persons who didn't invade the home who were also tied up in this organization. And our analyst was able to essentially make the case through analysis of cell tower records, which were able to put people in particular locations at particular times and connect them through their phone calls and establish the organization. So that was actually, the district attorney called and thanked us for that and said he would not have been able to make that case without our analyst's efforts. Here's another very significant initiative that we've started with in the last 2 years, and this has to do with law enforcement safety when they are conducting things such as surveillances or search warrants. Now, this is a map which will show, by example, if a police officer was doing a search warrant at 59 Rosemont in West Salem. It used to be that the officer had no way to check to see if there were other police officers in the area. And it's not uncommon for police officers to both come down on the same house or neighboring houses. Under this new system that we have in place, a police officer can submit to our office where he's going to conduct the search warrant. And then if we have learned from another agency that they're doing something in the same neighborhood, we can put them together and make sure that they don't conflict. And you'd be surprised how frequently that happens. I believe that we had 700 events entered into our database last year. We had conflicts in over 100 of them. And it's particularly significant in the metro areas where that occurs.
Senator Winters has pointed out that we're looking at a small area in her district.
Just wanted to point that out to the members here.
Chair Gorley, Senator Winters, this is just by way of illustration and doesn't represent any particular case.
Nice cover.
I don't know why we selected Doug's address.
I'm saucy.
And then briefly, if I could touch on our terrorism efforts as well. We have devoted an analyst as well as one investigator to a full-time effort in coordinating gathering intelligence with regard to terrorism statewide, working with law enforcement to try to create a network of police officers so when they see something, they contact us. And as I was leaving my office today, we had just concluded one of those meetings. On a quarterly basis, we bring together law enforcement, federal and state, from all over the Northwest for, as an example, on white supremacist organizations that are taking place within the Northwest. We get together regularly, share information. The other areas that we focus are international terrorism and eco-terrorism, which seems to be the three areas that we're primarily dealing with in Oregon. And then this is the last slide, which reflects the proposed cuts under House Bill 3182. And obviously, with these types of cuts, we're going to have reduced services to district attorneys and law enforcement. And how it impacts us, I believe, is that we're not a very large organization, and we are a service organization that provides assistance to police officers and to district attorneys. And at some level, we pride ourselves in not saying no, because if we do say no to somebody, they're less likely to come back and ask for assistance. And if we have an expertise that they're not willing to ask for, I think then in the long run the state will suffer as a result of that. So,
Mr. Briggs, going back a few sentences, you touched on the presence of white supremacist activity in the state. Could you tell us briefly what that activity looks like today and what gives you concern and what should we be aware of?
Chair Gordley, I would say that we've seen an increase in activity with regard to white supremacists in the Northwest in general within the last several years. And the majority of that has been recruitment activity. We've seen there's an I don't want to get into specifics, but there are organizations that are engaging in outreach to juveniles and to children, and it's interesting that a significant part of what we're seeing is small events staged by white supremacist groups and then larger groups who come out to confront them, and that's one of the threats that law enforcement actually deals with. But we've seen an excellent increase in that type of activity, and the organizations that operate within that area are always evolving. You have people who rise to the top of an organization and then they disappear or they splinter off and go and form their own separate group. But it's an area of significant concern that we pay attention to.
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I just need to point out on the slide, and if the agency could correct me, I think the amount of reductions here reflect not only the organized crime unit, but also the crime victims budget by the looks of the totals. So,
correct.
So all these reductions, it would be coming out of this program as well as the next one on the list.
Madam Chair, if I could add to that, Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services, the governor also took the reductions. So the reductions they're talking about here are on top of reductions that were taken in the governor's budget.
These are in addition? In addition to
these would be in addition if you chose to take them.
Does that conclude your presentation? Representative Wisner.
Did we get your FTEs? You're not talking about a lot of FTEs, are you, sir? In your this department? What's your total FTEs?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisner, in the entire Criminal Justice Division, I believe we have 87 FTE.
87 positions.
Correct.
Thank you.
That includes crime victims as well as DA assist and organized crime.
Mr. Briggs, we thank you very much for not only your time, but your presentation and thoroughness. And we look forward to visiting with you on another occasion. Thank you very much. We will now bring up Connie Gallagher, to talk with us about the Crime Victims Assistance Program or Department. And please go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Director of Crime Victims Assistance at the Department of Justice. And I'm here today to talk to you about crime victims, services, and funding from the standpoint of a crime victim, from the standpoint of an 81-year-old gentleman with dementia who was beaten by an acquaintance and her accomplice for drug money, from the standpoint of a 3-year-old who was kicked in the stomach by his mother, and from the standpoint of a 21-year-old exchange student who was sexually assaulted by her host father. These individuals, through no fault of their own, have been victims of devastating acts of personal violence. Oregon, like every other state in the country, believes that the right thing to do is to assist these victims to regain, to whatever extent they're able to, the ability to lead a safe, productive, and a satisfying life. Our mission is to provide assistance to victims of violent crime through provision of a direct service called the Crime Victims Compensation Program, as well as to provide assistance through grants and technical support to other direct service providers in the communities throughout Oregon. Our section has 26 staff along with a dedicated fiscal analyst. As you've heard, Crime Victims Assistance is one of four sections within the Criminal Justice Division. Our section is organized into two subsections. The first represents the direct services aspect of our business, which is primarily the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This is inclusive of child abuse medical assessments and a sexual assault victims emergency medical response fund. The other subsection represents our grant and technical support services for the local service providers I mentioned who operate throughout the entire state. The next slide shows the portion of the governor's recommended budget for DOJ that goes to crime victims assistance. The slide following that will show you more specifically how our crime victims assistance revenue is spent. What you will see is that approximately 69% of our available revenue is distributed back to local community programs that provide services to crime victims. This includes programs you're all aware of in your communities, domestic violence shelters, sexual assault hotlines, child abuse services, along with many other services for special populations and other types of crime victims. Approximately 18% of our available revenue will go directly back to crime victims for applicants who are eligible for our crime victims compensation program. 12% of our revenue will be used for operational costs. The next slide provides even more detail in regards to our current state revenue, which supports victim services. By and large, in Oregon, crime victim services are presently supported through fines, fees, judgments, and assessments that are paid by offenders or others who are ordered by the court to make such payments through either a criminal or a civil proceeding. What you see along the left-hand side of the slide are the various types of payments, and these include unitary assessment, subrogation, punitive damages, restitution, and occasionally contributions that we receive from individuals. Sometimes we receive donations from inmates of the correctional institutions, for example. The current criminal fines and assessment account appropriation, along with the other fund revenue, supports several different types of services that you see along the right-hand side of this slide. Through the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention account up in the upper right-hand corner, the funds support the capacity of each county to provide a child-sensitive, multidisciplinary approach to child abuse investigations, along with payment of forensic medical assessments for children who are alleged to be victims of child abuse. The Crime Victims Compensation Program provides funds for direct reimbursement to victims of violent crime for those out-of-pocket costs that they have incurred as a result of their victimization. Funds also provide financial support for victim assistance programs in all 36 prosecutor offices throughout our state. If there's an adequate balance in the criminal injuries compensation account, those funds may also support a variety of other victim services through a state grant program. Lastly, of course, it supports our operational costs. I will be briefly describing each of these programs. However, at this point, I'd like to reference the yellow folder that I believe each of you have. And in there, you will see some not-so-pretty yellow handouts. But what these will provide for you is a list of all the grantees by county and by program type, and you will see the dollar amounts that go to each of your each of the counties within the state through all of the programs that we administer.
Ms. Gallagher, it would be helpful also to understand how the amounts received match up with the actual need being experienced in a given county.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to get you some information on that as a follow-up. I don't have anything with me.
Certainly. That would be fine. What are the winners?
Question. This the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention account, and then I look at the Regional Child Abuse Assessment Centers, which is in Portland, Medford, and Bend. Do they interface or interact with CARES? And that's the centers who do some assessments and then report back to children and families.
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, it's a very well-coordinated system, and I will get back into...
Would you get back to me on that?
That a little bit more.
My next question is, then, Are those assessments, do they also bill independent of what's happening with you to, let's say, for example, children and families? But what are these interconnectors that are taking place between that organization, which I understand is independent, that does assessment of abuse and neglect, and who is then responsible for reporting back their findings to children and families and to the court? So I'm just trying to get my arms around where everybody fits in all these multiple interagency or interactivities.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I'll be providing more information on that, but please, if you would bring forward any questions that you don't think I've answered when I've gone into a little bit more detail on
that,
I'd be happy to answer.
I raised that because I had a concern about a specific incident that was at North, and where you had the assessments taking place and where the child had been removed and the custodial parent, who was not being charged, by the way, had not received any information on the assessment and results for almost a month, which causes some real concerns. And so I'm trying to get my arms around how all of this interconnection and the reporting and everything takes place and who pays and who's responsible for it.
The next two slides briefly describe the programs and services that are currently being supported through the criminal fines and assessment account. The appropriation that's designated as the criminal injuries compensation account is inclusive of the crime victims compensation program and the district attorney victim assistance programs. The crime victims compensation program receives 50% of the CICA appropriation, while the other 50% is redistributed by formula back out to the county programs, and again, all 36 county prosecutor's offices receive a portion of it, along with five city attorney offices that also have a victim assistance program. The other services currently supported by criminal fines and assessment account include the coordinated multidisciplinary approach to investigations supported through the CAMI account, three regional child abuse assessment centers, which Senator Winters just mentioned, that are located in Medford, Portland, and Bend. And again, these provide technical support, training, and specialized expertise services to all the centers throughout the state. And the Child Abuse Medical Assessment Fund, which provides funding for the assessments of alleged victims of child abuse. I'd like to describe these programs in a bit more detail, beginning with the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This program was statutorily authorized in 1977. Every state in America has a crime victims compensation program. The primary funding for all these programs comes from fines, fees, and penalties paid by defendants in criminal cases. The purpose of every compensation program is to provide reimbursement to innocent victims of violent crime and their families who have no other means of paying for expenses incurred because of a criminal act. The program also encourages cooperation with the criminal justice system by requiring that each of the applicants have reported the crime to law enforcement and also that they cooperate with prosecution of the case. The program is the payer of last resort. An example is the 81-year-old that I mentioned in my earlier comments who was beaten by a female acquaintance and her male accomplice. The elderly man had given money to the woman in the past, but just recently had come to understand that she was using this to purchase drugs, so he had refused to give her money. As a consequence, they tied him up and beat him. While Medicare covered his medical expenses, Crime Victims Compensation paid $1,000 to cover his out-of-pocket costs that had been paid for dental work as a result of the assault. Benefits include assistance with crime-related costs up to...
Yes, Representative.
What did we do to the person who raped the foreign exchange student?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnant, I'm going to get to that in a little bit.
You're going to skip that one.
Over 5,000 Oregonians per year submit applications for crime victims compensation. Again, referencing your folder here, you will find a blue trifold brochure which will go into more detail about the eligibility requirements as well as possible reimbursement for people who qualify under crime victims compensation. The program's key performance measure is the timeliness with which the section makes an eligibility determination on an application. Back in January of 1999, the section was only processing approximately 23% of new applications in less than 90 days. Additional funding and position authority allowed us to hire new staff. This, in conjunction with new technology, now has us routinely processing 90% of our applications in 90 days or less. As a matter of fact, we process 75% of our applications in 60 days or less. And even though our chair did not hear this presentation, in anticipation of a question she might ask, I will mention that our performance measure was determined through surveys of other compensation programs across the country, also by looking at what's best practice within the field, and finally by doing a lot of questions, asking a lot of questions of anyone and everyone in terms of what do you think is a reasonable response time if you are a victim who is submitting an application. So that's initially our performance measure was 80% within 90 days, and we were able to successfully maintain that for a year, so we increased it to completing eligibility determinations at the rate of 90% within 90 days. We've been able to do that.
Senator Winter?
Just a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. How would I know that this, the Victim Assistance Program exists in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, by statute, law enforcement officers are required to notify victims of crime victims' compensation. Every law enforcement agency is given materials to hand out, everything from simple wallet cards as well as the applications to provide for victims. In addition to that, all of the recipients of funds, all of their roughly 150 agencies that receive some funding through our section, by our contractual arrangement with them, they are also obligated to inform and assist victims with application of crime victims' compensation.
Thank you.
The number of applications has shown a slow and steady increase each year. As you can see by the slide, in 1999, we processed a little over 3,000 applications a year. In 2004, we've processed over 5,000 claim applications, an increase of approximately 58%. What drives the increase in new claim applications? Contrary to what you might think, it's not as simple as looking at whether our crime rate is on the rise or the decline. There are many other factors that impact this slow and steady increase that you see. Some of the factors include statutory changes that are made, such as the one made to increase the number of individuals that would be eligible. And one example of this is children who witness domestic violence. They're now eligible for a limited amount of counseling through this program. Also, of course, the economic situation of victims, such as unemployment, other economic factors for people who become victims, certainly impacts whether they apply for crime victims' compensation. Coverage changes by insurance providers and simple public awareness of the program are also important factors in determining whether we see an increase. In addition, we do, of course, look at specific types of crime, and, for example, child abuse. We know that that's on the rise, 12.1% increase. For child sex abuse, it's 20%. So, again, even though overall you might see a decline in crime rates, when you look at specific types of crime, you may see an increase, and that contributes to an increase in our applications. The program provides just under 5,000 victims a year with financial reimbursement. As you can see by this next slide, the program anticipates paying out over $6 million in this biennium. You probably won't be surprised to know that the largest category of payments is for reimbursement of medical costs. As this bar graph shows, to make payments, we must utilize federal funds, other funds, and a biennial appropriation, which is currently through criminal fines and assessment. The proportion supported by the biennial criminal fines and assessment appropriation is decreasing each biennium, as you can see by the dark blue segment on the bar graph. In the past, due to...
Ms. Gallagher, excuse me, I ask you to stop just for a moment. Senator Devlin?
Just a clarification on medical expenses. There is coordination in terms of if those medical expenses are covered by outside health plans that the individual has, or if they are an OHP recipient.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, crime victims' compensation is the pair of last resort. So, yes, all those other resources are utilized first.
I know.
In the past, due to a 60% federal match on the state dollars and the additional revenue that comes into the criminal injuries compensation account through punitive damages, restitution, subrogation, the program has been able to meet the needs of victims without having to substantially reduce reimbursements. However, as the state expenditures decline, so will the federal match, of course. Also, other fund revenue, those punitive damages, restitution, subrogation, upon which, as you can see, our payments are becoming increasingly reliant, are a very unstable source of revenue. This next slide compares our state revenues with expenditures over time. For each biennium, you see two bars, the multi-segmented bar representing the criminal injuries compensation account resources, and a bar with the horizontal orange line, which represents all other fund expenditures. As you can see, by 05-07, over on the right-hand side of the slide, our other fund expenditures will exceed the anticipated revenue available to reimburse victims for necessary services unless additional revenue is found or significant cost containment measures are implemented. It's been as recently as this Monday that I was made aware of a potential punitive damage award that might affect our projections. By March, the various steps that were necessary to secure these funds should have occurred, clearing the way for utilization of these monies for victim services. Again, this exemplifies the unpredictable nature of our resource base. This next slide shows the reduction in the governor's recommended budget relative to the current criminal fines and assessment account appropriation, recognizing that the governor's recommended budget is proposing that this become general fund rather than criminal fines and assessment account monies for 05-07. The crime victims compensation program is sensitive, very sensitive, to policy and funding shifts in other programs serving the same population. As an example, I might reference the Oregon Health Plan. A large number of our crime victims compensation claimants have Oregon Health Plan if they have any insurance at all. Changes within Oregon Health Plan will have a dramatic effect on our payments. For example, last year, the Oregon Health Plan dropped hospital services that were not for urgent care, dropped physical therapy, along with a large dental provider, and closed the program to new clients. The result is a cost shift to programs like crime victims compensation, which, as I said, is the payer of last resort. Cost containment measures, such as a limit on the number of sessions and a no-waiver policy, have already been implemented by this program. A more significant cost containment plan has been developed, and we will put this into effect if it is necessary after further review of our seventh quarter expenditures and our CICA projected revenues. Any reductions would be in addition to a 25% reduction that we currently impose on medical provider billings through our administrative fee schedule. As mentioned, 50% of what has been the CICA appropriation of the criminal fines and assessment account is distributed back out to county and city victim assistance programs. These programs were established in 1983 to assist victims whose case proceeds through the criminal justice system. Each program has volunteers and has paid advocates to provide a variety of services which are listed in statute. I'll mention just a couple of these services. One is ensuring that victims are informed of their rights within the criminal justice system and helping to ensure that those are enforced. Another is assisting victims with the applications of crime victims compensation, as I mentioned earlier. Also, of course, the advocates prepare and accompany the victim as the case proceeds through the criminal justice system. In your folder, you will find a more complete list of the services that are provided by these programs. An advocate in one of these programs helped the 21-year-old exchange student who was the victim of rape by her host father to better understand what was a very confusing criminal justice process for her. They also accompanied her to hearings and helped her to access much-needed services. Representative Wisnett, I believe there was a very positive outcome to that prosecution, but I would like to double-check that and get back to you.
Hope the gentleman paid dearly.
Local advocates may also provide death notification and crisis response in addition to accompanying and supporting victims as their case proceeds through the criminal justice system. Funds earmarked for the victim assistance programs in the governor's recommended budget are again a reduction from the current expenditure limitation. What's anticipated is a 10% reduction, 40507, in addition to roughly a 5.5% reduction in the 0305 biennium. These services are not funded at a level that provides for paid employees to conduct the full range of services that are listed in statute. I would like to emphasize that these programs are heavily dependent upon volunteers. For example, the Multnomah Rape Crisis Team is staffed only by volunteers. While on the face of it, it might seem as though a reduction or an elimination of a volunteer coordinator position is not significant, when that person is the sole support for a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week volunteer service for rape victims, it can have a very significant impact. Unfortunately, even at the current funding level, some programs are not able to fully comply with the statutory list of services. Next, I'd like to talk about the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account, or the CAMI program, as we call it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. In a case where you were paying compensation for expenses to a victim, and the victim came from a difficult situation, i.e., maybe didn't qualify or have any other payee possibilities, no other health insurance or that kind of thing, but fit somewhere just above that. And let's say they didn't have a bank account or they didn't have the capacity for payment personally. Are you assisting with that? In other words, that the person through their crime has debt service on medical or vehicle or any number of other things that get repaired. How are you sure that those payments get to the provider of the benefits?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we do make payments directly to providers on behalf of the victim.
You do?
Yes.
So it doesn't go to the victim
Correct.
First?
So we make sure that it's okay. Going for the service that's crime-related.
Thank you.
Ms. Gallagher, before you go further, I want to go back to the previous slide, and I want you to know that I'm really hearing what you're saying about the limited volunteer recruitment, training, how all of that is impacted when we're looking at reduction in services. It reminds me of an experience I had working as a volunteer rape victim advocate in Multnomah County. Know what it's like to get that call at 3 o'clock in the morning. You show up at the hospital, and there's the victim, there's the police officer, and you, and perhaps a family member or someone else who's really concerned about what's happened with the victim. But again, it's all dependent on the availability of volunteers, and that's very very tenuous situation. So again, as you were speaking, it just brought back those experiences to my mind.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for speaking so eloquently to the importance of volunteers. It's very true. Next, I'd like to talk about the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account. This program is the sole source of state funding for a multidisciplinary approach to the assessment, investigation, and prosecution of child abuse cases. It provides funding for the multidisciplinary teams across the state, as well as funding for state-of-the-art assessment and advocacy centers. Your folder provides you with some additional information about why these funds are so important, in particular, what investigations were like before CAMI funding and what investigations are like at the present time. A key aspect of the exceptional infrastructure Oregon has for unbiased, child-sensitive approach to assessment and investigation of child abuse is the network of intervention centers that operates throughout Oregon. All counties in Oregon have access to these assessment services if there are funds available, and usually they use CAMI funds in order to contract for these services. The 19 centers throughout the state are generally non-governmental entities with independent boards or perhaps an affiliation with a larger medical facility, such as CARES Northwest's affiliation with Legacy Emmanuel in Portland. All of the centers have significant support from their local communities and are supported by multiple types of funding. In general, they are leveraging between $4 and $6 private dollars for every state dollar that they receive through the CAMI program.
Ms. Gallagher, what does access really look like on the ground when you look at the middle of the state and those areas where you don't have a dot? I know you're saying that there's access, but what does that mean if you live in Harney County or Grant County?
Madam Chair, to be realistic about it, it means there's a significant amount of driving that's involved in order to have a child assessed at one of those assessment centers. There's been no limitation on the growth of these centers. These centers develop where there is the level of community support, both in a monetary sense as well as in a people resource sense, in order to get a center built. Obviously, the money that the state provides is just a small portion of what's necessary to develop a center and maintain its services. So that's why I think you see that there's an area in the state where there isn't quite as much coverage or close coverage in terms of assessment services.
It would be interesting, Ms. Gallagher, to see an overlay of numbers of child abuse cases in each of those counties, cases that would be eligible for services through the intervention centers, just so that we get an even clearer picture of what the access challenges are.
Madam Chair, would you like me to bring that back to you?
Thank you. Senator Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It actually goes along the same lines of your request. I had some inquiries a number of years back about one of my metropolitan counties. I won't identify which one, but it's the one that does not have a dot on it. And they were really, I'm trying to phrase this very carefully. Their history in terms of dealing with these cases on a higher percentage level, or as high a percentage as some counties, was somewhat lower. In terms of, I think you're using the language here, substantiated cases, and I know that there are cases that actually go through, you know, preliminary review and you decide whether to proceed, and I was looking at all of that data at that time. Can you get that kind of data for the counties in terms of number of reports? And my understanding at that time was that there was a greater effort, and I'm not going to use any acronyms, but there was a greater effort to work between in the entities and the Department of Human Services. It took me so long to actually quit calling Children and Services Division, not Children's Services, but Services. Oh, we'll forget that. So I don't even know what to call them anymore other than Department of Human Services. But just to see how this is working in terms of, because they made some references to me a couple years back that they were going to be improving their rates of actually the number of cases that were reviewed.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I believe that's on the DHS website in terms of their annual reports, and I'd be happy to give that. Pardon me? Uh-oh. I don't seem to have any fun with
that. That's what I just said to the Attorney General's account.
Let's move on and talk about the CAMI budget, if I may. When the multidisciplinary team proposed appropriation is combined with a proposal for regional centers, the governor's recommended budget intends a reduction from $8.1 million to $7.3 for 05-07. While funding is declining, unfortunately, child abuse is rising, with the latest figure showing, as I mentioned, a 12.1% increase in substantiated reports overall, and specifically in the area of child sex abuse, showing a 20% increase.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winters.
There is a and I'm on the Human Services
Sabbathsville is on this sub. And as I look at this particular activity, my question is how much that is going on with the sinners, that also the agency, if it's involved in those activities, if this is in addition to the child welfare activity. Because, you know, my concern is statutorily the agency has some responsibilities involved in this kind of investigative process. So I'd like to know who all is when we say child abuse multidisciplinary account, who all is involved in that account. For me, you can bring it back later as to the who actually are the participants that are conducting the assessments.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I won't go into a great deal of detail. You did ask a fairly complex question, but essentially the way it works is the assessment centers are staffed with medical professionals that CPS doesn't have, DHS doesn't have. They're staffed with neutral interviewers. In other words, they're not governmental employees. They're not vested in the outcome one way or the other. The centers also have state-of-the-art equipment that the state clearly does not have in order to conduct medical exams. So they have a whole different level of assessment that they provide. In general, the CPS workers, although I probably should not speak for them, but I have been a CPS worker in the past, generally their assessment is at a different level because they obviously aren't qualified to do the physical assessment and do the other type of interviewing that you find at assessment centers.
Another clarification on the reports of child abuse. The 20% increase in child sex abuse, is that 20% of the 12.1, or is that a separate category of cases?
Well, Madam Chair, that would be a subset of the 12.1.
All right. Representative Wilson and then Representative Wisnett.
What? Thank you, Madam Chair. On the 12% unsubstantiated reports, what's the time period that you're talking about for that 12% happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that figure was gathered from the annual Child Protective Services report that's released by the Department of Human Services. So I believe it's an annual figure, probably. I'm not sure whether they use the calendar year or our state fiscal year, one of those two, for the last year. That was the 2004 report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Gallagher, I'm trying to understand this because my people that provide this service in Deschutes County have been over to talk to me about it. The way I understand it, the governor said that the funds that come out of this trust fund, or the money we collect from
criminal fines,
will not be able to be used back in there. That's the actual cut. Is that correct? And or there's actually less money. You can explain that to me. And this morning I was sitting on the Education Committee with a couple of the senators here, and we understand the governor is cutting Head Start, and now the governor's cut this. And this seems strange that these are below the priority line. Can you comment on that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, Kelly Friels with the Budget Management Division. First, let me talk about the governor's process for moving criminal fines and assessment dollars into the general fund. Criminal fines and assessment dollars are used for a variety of purposes, including the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I think if you remember a conversation we had in the overview, that particular agency is expanding substantially and has priority over those dollars. So as a result of that, the dollars remaining in that fund, the criminal fines and assessment account, would have accounted for about a 28% reduction to all other programs. We recognized in building the governor's budget that these programs should compete priority-wise with all the other general fund programs, and in reality, from our perspective, that's what happens.
So the governor said, let's not have this artificial barrier between the criminal fines and assessment dollars and general fund. When we know, when we're figuring out what the priorities are, we think about it as one unit. So the governor is putting those dollars into the general fund with the understanding then you do the prioritization of these programs in concert with all the other programs. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part that you asked, why did this go below the line? I think, and you'll see a number of programs like this in the governor's recommended budget that had to be cut just because of the reduction in revenues available. I think in the public safety area, the problem that we had in making these reductions is when you took the reductions in concert with the amount of money we had available and understanding that we couldn't make any substantial reductions in the Department of Corrections budget, which you will hear next week, that left very few places to take reductions.
Mr. Wilson, did you wish to comment?
No, I was passing the clock to Mr. Fournier.
All right.
And Mr. Wilson, I do appreciate that.
Senator Williams.
I think there's one way to explain it. However, it doesn't get us at this body's going to have to probably make some decision as to what truly is the priority.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it is really that we need to take those funds and put them in general fund, or whether the intent is to continue where we were in the past. And so that's going to be the decision that this is going to make, because clearly in looking at the increase in child abuse and neglect in this state, and tie it with some of the other criminal problems that are occurring in the state, and I'm thinking of the drug and methamphetamine use, and which has become epidemic, we're going to have some serious decisions to make, both with respect to this particular budget as well as the human services budget, because there's some direct relationships between the two. And it's no doubt in my mind that children and families are at risk in it and are being harmed in this state. So,
Madam Chair, if I may, as the Senator Winter already knows, and you already know, you're going to be making some tremendous decisions here within the resources available, and none of them are going to be real pleasant.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
Since we're getting on the issue of criminal fines and assessments and how they're used in priorities, I'm not trying to get more visits from the Association of Oregon Counties or the League of Oregon Cities, but I still think we have this outstanding issue out there with training going to be costing much more than it has in the past, and the expansion of training, whether there should not be a difference in the sharing of that cost of the training, and actually whether internally we should be accounting for some of the costs of our own training that occurs through BPSSD, like for the Corrections Division, in terms of accounting for that training there. I mean, it's a discussion that we had last session, and I know it's a discussion the cities and counties don't like to hear, but when the cost of your facilities are more than doubling, practically, in terms of costs, I mean, I think that discussion has to be had.
Well, members, I would just say that it is a discussion that we will definitely have, and we will put it, we will have it in alignment with the budget principles that we will have in front of us as we make that choice and many others. Ms. Gallagher, I would ask you to continue, and if you could move toward wrapping up. Thank you.
I have asked the numerous professionals who are involved in investigating child abuse what a reduction would mean in terms of their services. The responses I received include a reduction in specialized training of investigators and healthcare professionals, reduction in staff, reduction in availability of medical professionals, timeliness of response, timeliness of investigations. So ultimately, a failure to support what truly is an exceptional system that Oregon has developed over the last 15 years will result in the outcomes that you see on the next slide. An increase in the trauma to children as a result of delays in coordinated investigations and a child-sensitive investigative and assessment process. an increase in wasted investigative time and resources, which presently is minimized due to the exceptional quality of expertise that's available. A decrease in the ability to keep children safe, a decrease in the ability to hold offenders accountable through successful prosecution, which, of course, is dependent upon good investigation as well as support services for victims to help them as the case proceeds through what's an arduous criminal justice process. The department has three other grant programs that support services for victims of crime: the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, a state grant program, and two federal crime victims grants that we receive on an ongoing basis. One is a formula grant and one is the match grant that I mentioned earlier. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into detail on the state grant program or the federal grants. You will find additional information in your yellow folder. However, I'd briefly like to mention the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. This fund currently provides the only general fund dollars to assist with a significant problem in Oregon, and that is the problem of domestic violence and sexual violence. The Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund provides approximately $2.4 million to approximately 50 local private nonprofits, no public entities, to provide essential services such as shelters and hotlines for victims of domestic and sexual violence. This $2.4 million is estimated to be roughly 4% of what would be necessary to truly impact and reduce the incidence of domestic violence in Oregon. The governor's recommended budget is proposing to reduce this 2.4 down to 2.2. The next slide is the 10%.
Ms. Gallagher, before you leave that piece, I believe we need a performance measure for the domestic violence program. I'm trying to find the page here.
And can we also have some outcomes on the trauma to children, the whole child abuse multidisciplinary intervention account, because you target some specific areas, and it would be nice to see what those results are.
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, I will get back to you with additional information. I will just say to you that one of the outcomes that we've tracked for the domestic and sexual violence is safety planning and assistance with that. Because the dollars are so small relative to the cost of doing services, we evaluated in conjunction with other domestic violence dollars administered through DHS and at times through state police. But the outcome that we have found is that 92% of the women who have receive services through a shelter leave having received assistance with safety planning. First they received a safety assessment, and then they've engaged in actual safety planning.
Madam Chair,
certainly.
Could you also provide us with, if you have it, whether or not there has been an increase in domestic violence that you can link to an increase in the drug use, particularly methamphetamine?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I'd be happy to look into that.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know the best process to get this information, but you mentioned your domestic violence grant program. Department of Human Resources or Services and State Police. Is there a way that we could get all these cross jurisdictions between our committees? Is there a way we could get like a one-page memo that would show the amounts and what they do and how they differ?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, I do have a one-page that will give you exactly what you've requested.
Thank you.
This next slide shows the 10% reduction from the governor's recommended budget across all fund types, and the Attorney General will be speaking more on this in his closing comments, so I will not speak to it at this point. My final slide speaks to something that, again, is very important to us from a program standpoint. We seek client feedback as an integral part of all of our programs. The final slide shows you a few of the comments that we've received from Oregonians who've used our services during the past year. while you're reviewing these comments, I'd like to share one of the personal favorites that we received from a gentleman who wrote and said, "I must say, I never thought a government agency truly cared about people until I had this experience. Now I talk about you all the time. My thanks goes out to you and all your staff." So with that, I conclude my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Well, our thanks goes to you, Ms. Gallagher, for helping us gain a fuller understanding of the services provided. I will share with you that as I met with each member of this committee, we have a very deep concern about services for victims and wanting to make sure that the access is there and that the services, real services, are there as well. So again, we thank you for your time and presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee.
And we look forward to visiting with you on another occasion. Coming up to bat is Tim Wood. Notice you're out there shifting chairs, moving forward. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Timothy Wood. I'm the Chief Trial Counsel for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here this afternoon to talk to you about the trial division. And what I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit of who we are, how we fit in the organization, something about our funding, and where I think we're going to go regarding litigation in this state for the next biennium. First of all, who we are. We're just one of the seven divisions that you learned about earlier. We're the trial division. Not surprisingly enough, what we do is try cases. As you've heard from other divisions and teams that have been before you, there are other teams that actually appear in court. For example, you heard Mr. Briggs earlier talked about our criminal side. They're doing the criminal litigation. Heard from Fred Boss, who talked about the civil enforcement, financial fraud, civil recovery. They appear, they're the plaintiff side. We're appear in court, in the trial court, when we defend the state, its agents, and employees. How are we funded? What you'll find is the trial division. There's two types of funds. We've got other funds and the general funds. What I'm here to talk to you this afternoon about are the other funds. Mary Williams will be up here in a moment and be talking about the general fund component of the trial division. If we could, I'd like to take a look at our mission statement and ask you to focus just for a moment. And a lot will be told to you if you look at just the first word of our mission statement. And what you see there is that our mission is to defend the state. And when I say that it tells you a lot, what it tells you is the fact of the matter is we don't really have a lot of choices in what it is that we do. So that we appear when the state gets sued. So, for example, as you read this week, when there was a challenge to Measure 36, we have one of two choices. Either we not appear, in which case the petitioners win, or we do appear and defend. You read not too long ago that there was a challenge to Measure 37. The same analysis goes through where we either have a choice of defending or not defending. So who we are in the grand scheme of things is that we are reactive. Other people make a choice to sue the state, and we defend them. How do we do that? We try to use the most cost-effective processes available, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Another thing that we try to do is provide what I characterize as a just resolution of every claim. I think you're going to find that if you talk to people that work in the trial division and the Department of Justice, we have somewhat different than your typical insurance carrier defense firm. And that when we look at a particular issue, we can make the determination as to what is the right thing to do in a particular case. Let me give you an example of a case that I talked about this morning. We have a situation where we had children in foster care. The agency made a determination that it would be in the best interest of these particular children that they be moved and reunited with their siblings, and that there is an adoptive parent or parents that would be willing to take these children. The foster parents, who has had this one child for a period of time, disagrees with this. Well, what's the best answer here? Well, one of the things that we looked at is saying doing the right thing is that it's difficult to look at really what is the right answer, but what the best thing we can do for these children is get an early resolution of it. Let the court make a decision as what's in the best interest of the foster parents, of the children, of the siblings, and of the adopted parents. So when I meet with new attorneys that are applying for jobs or the new attorney that we've just hired, we're able to talk to them and say, look, we are in a unique situation, that we are able to do the right thing for the right reason. Why do we defend these cases? As you look at our mission statement here, one of the reasons is to look at the outcome of what happens in the event that we don't defend. And I'm going to suggest that there's two things that can happen. One, it's a dollar and cents, and two, policy. The county has recently filed a lawsuit within the last 30 days, maybe the last 60 days. Okay. This legislative assembly made a determination last session that they would remove $10 million from the forestry fund and bring that into the general fund. The counties disagree. That's their money, they say. And so they have filed a lawsuit challenging that. If we don't defend, that's $10 million that we remove then from the general fund. Similarly, legislative policies are very important. So when we look at today, the challenges to Measure 36, to Measure 37, who were there was we're there on behalf of the people and on this legislative assembly to assure that the legislative policies or the voters' policies are in fact carried out. The next slide I have for you is an organizational chart. And this actually will do a couple things for you. One, it will give you an idea of just what it is that we do in the trial division. And two, it will give you an idea of how we do it. So first, let's just take a moment and look at how we, what we do. And what you'll see there is that there are four teams that handle particular areas. And if you look at just the names of those teams, it'll give you a feel for what it is that we do. So, for example, when you start on the left-hand side there, you'll see that we have a commercial condemnation and environmental team. Well, what they do is they do our commercial litigation. If you think of the state of Oregon as a large corporation, and probably, in fact, I'm confident that it would be compared, that there isn't a larger corporation in this state. Needless to say, we get involved with a substantial number of commercial matters. We buy property, we sell property, we lease property. Well, needless to say, there are disputes that arise during the course of that, and we get sued, and then we appear on their behalf. Similarly, when we're out and we're building roads or we're building bridges, we may be taking property. And when we do that, then we need to compensate the landowners for the fair market value. If we do that, there's a condemnation process. Then there's also the environmental part of this. So you think of the spotted owl, for example, and the impact that that's had on us. So when there's litigation over the spotted owl, so a property owner says that they should not have prevented me from harvesting my timber, I'm going to challenge the actions of the Department of Environmental Quality or the Department of Forestry. They'll file a lawsuit. We'll defend the Department of Environmental Quality or the Oregon Department of Forestry. As you move from the left, you have the corrections litigation, and I'm not going to talk about this. This is going to be rolled into our defense of criminal convictions that Mary Williams will talk about when I identify for you the fact that our services are paid by other fund and general fund. This primarily is a program that's funded through general funding. Special litigation is our team that defends our core constitutional issues and legislative policies. I've already referenced the Measure 36 and Measure 37. Tort litigation is probably one of the largest component of the trial division, and when we look at the funding for the trial division, which is about $15 million for other fund, the tort litigation is about $9 million of that $15 million that we're talking about. And I'm not sure, if I say tort litigation...
Senator Devlin.
Yeah. In your presentation, could you actually talk a little bit about if you work and how you work with, I don't know the proper terminology, but the risk management section of the Department of Administrative Services and trying to minimize the state's exposure?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. I'll do that. In fact, what we'll find here is after the next slide here, we'll talk. It is a slide that really is a combination of the Department of Justice as well as risk management and how we approach tort litigation. Okay. So when we talk about tort litigation, I think torts is actually one of those things that lawyers, you know, just take for granted. Everybody knows what tort is, but this is my way of defining a tort. But something goes wrong, someone's injured, and they maintain somebody owes them money for it, and they file a lawsuit. That's a tort. And if you think about it, to give you a feel for the scope of this, I just thought of some statistics. Like, if you think that there are 36,000 employees, think of yourself, and I know a number of you here, your own individual businesses, and think about the concerns you have regarding your tort liability or tort exposure. Now multiply that, or divide that, if you will, into the 36,000 state employees that we have. That says nothing about, for example, the volunteers that we have. This morning I had a call from Oregon State University, and you'd be surprised to learn that our 4-H leaders are volunteers, if you will, that we bring into the state system. So we cover not only these 36,000 state employees, but we cover these volunteers. We cover agents. For example, the Department of Corrections goes out and will contract with doctors in the community to assist them in providing services to inmates. These doctors become agents, and we end up defending them. So our exposure is huge, and as a result of it, we see a lot of litigation.
Question on the exposure.
Senator your winners.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Department of Administrative Services is it's self-insured. Do we also require individuals to have professional errors and omissions insurance? Or has that been a discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I don't believe we do. That there isn't a separate policy for errors and omissions. That if there is a tort, if something is done wrong by an employee, agent, elected official, then the Department of Administrative Services covers them. I know that we do have bonds in some situations, performance bonds, but that's all I'm familiar with. Let me just, if I could back up just for a moment here, Kevin, and take a look at the last slide here, because the other thing that I wanted to emphasize is I indicated I would give you a feel for what we do and also how we do it. Two things this slide gives you is that when you look at the volume of work that flows through the Department of Justice and the Trial Division, when you look at what's the most cost-effective way you can deliver this service, one of the things that should appear from this organizational chart, or does appear from this organizational chart, is that we do it through specialization. I mean, that's one of the tools that we have in order to address the volume of material that matters that come before us. So if you look at how we're organized, that's based upon those areas of specialization. And the second part is that if you look at the portion of the slide that deals with the governor's recommended budget, what doesn't show there is the breakdown of how the staff is divided in the trial division. And when you look at how we're divided, what you're going to find is that we're very highly weighted for support staff, investigators, and paralegals. I'll share a story with you that the first time I appeared before this Ways and Means, and I put together a policy package. I forget what the need was. It was a number of years ago, and my first response as an attorney is, what we need is more attorneys. That's just what we need, more attorneys. And so I moved the policy package forward and was successful in getting it forward. And you only find is that as you look at whatever the billing rate is, the fact of the matter is that providing attorneys is expensive, but it's less expensive if you can find support staff, paralegals, or investigators. And so what I've learned over the years is that as we look at this demand and our workload, is that one of the more cost-effective ways of delivering it is to make sure that we're doing it in the least cost-effective way or the most cost-effective way, and that's by providing support staff, investigators, and paralegals. There's nothing worse than going by a Xerox machine and finding an attorney at whatever he or she is billing at, running copies of that transcript. The next slide that you have here does demonstrate for you just what portion of the pie chart, how much the budget for the Department of Justice, the other funds, or the total funds, were $15 million out of the total funds.
Can you see that portion there?
Who are our major clients? Risk management, as Senator Winter indicates, that is one of our major clients. When we look within that client itself, who are some of the major agencies that take advantage of risk management? That would be the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Department of Corrections, and Department of Human Services. Some of our other clients include the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Department of Corrections. Now, Senator Winters, if you would look at the next slide that we have here. Well, it's actually behind you. We talk about our performance measures. How do we measure what kind of job we're doing? Two ways we looked at this. Number one, how many cases are you winning or the state's position is upheld? Another performance measure that we looked at is the percentage of litigation resolved through settlement. Over the years that we've learned that to the extent that we can resolve a matter through some sort of alternative dispute resolution, that it's less expensive than going through the risk of litigation and incurring those costs.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator,
will you have some dollar figures to so that I can look at the costs versus each one of those? I'm a restaurateur, you know, who deals in ribs and actuality, so it's just not enough for me to say, well, you know, the percentage of legal costs in which we were upheld, and what would it have cost us if we hadn't prevailed? And on the flip side of it is how much did it cost us to settle?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieners, I can develop some of those. I'm not sure I can develop all of that statistics.
Senator Delbert.
I would put one caveat on that, in that it is a, it might be reasonable to look at larger settlements the state has had to make in terms of, I don't understand this entirely, but I know that there are circumstances under which the state's tort liability can be exceeded, probably when it gets out and decide into a civil rights issue or something of that nature. But the other issue is I don't think you'd want entirely, you can give that figure, the claims, because I'm sure there have been some enormous, just totally baseless claims in terms of damages towards the state. I mean, I'm sure he's going to be able to bring us millions of dollars in claims where they settled for maybe, if it was substantiated, maybe $20,000 or $30,000.
I don't think it hurts us to know, even when we have baseless claims, because generally, if we're looking at transparency anymore, I don't, you know, we're involved in things in this building that sometimes the public doesn't know that we're involved with, that they are baseless. Or there's activity that's going on in your operation that you're having to do, you know, for example, that you wish you didn't have to do. So that's just my point. I think that there's a lot of activity taking place that when we look at performance measures that we're all looking for positive outcomes, you may or may not be able to produce that because of the mere fact of the kinds of claims and things that you're getting, and you must respond to them one way or the other. I hope I'm putting it in perspective.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin and Senator Winters, I know one of the statistics that we can generate for you is that we do keep with risk management, we do keep how much is spent on tort claims, what we paid out to plaintiff's attorneys, and question is whether one of the fields in the database would include what the claim was, and for the reasons that Senator Devlin indicates many times. So, for example, when we receive a complaint that is filed by an individual who may not be represented by an attorney, you'd see a claim for $1 billion, and it doesn't really add a lot to you. We haven't settled any of those, but kind of skew those statistics fairly quickly. Senator Winters asked, how do we work with risk management? What I would tell you is that we're very fortunate in working with risk management. I would consider it to be like a partnership,
and maybe seamless service would be a good way to describe what we do with risk management. And so what we do is that let me just back up for a moment. When we talk about risk management, before a claim can be filed, before a lawsuit can be filed against the state involving a tort, so the state has done something wrong, not a federal civil rights claim, that they need to tell risk management there's a problem and give risk management an opportunity to solve that problem. They have to notify them within 180 days of the time that something went wrong. So risk management, if you will, sees these claims initially. And what you have here in this particular exhibit is that you show that if we look at all of the claims that came into risk management, that you'll see there that risk management is able to resolve one way or another, either by denying the claim or resolving the claim about 90% of those cases. So what we'll do, Senator Winters, is that we will work with them. As a general rule, they have skilled claim adjusters to work with the claimants. But when there are times when there are particular problems that are unique that really are going to offer high exposure for the state, I can think of a case dealing with the Department of Corrections where a lawsuit had not been filed, but very serious concerns about by employees at the Department of Corrections. And we were able to jointly work with risk management to go through suit, to meet with a mediator, to meet with the claimants, and to resolve that particular claim before litigation had ever been filed. So we work closely with them once we identify big issues that are big ticket items for the state of Oregon. Then once that lawsuit has been filed, so they're unable to reach a resolution, they either deny it or they can't agree on the dollar amount, then we continue to work with them towards the resolution of that matter along the way.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think that part of the testimony is part of what I was hoping for, but I was hoping for something beyond that, that there's actually a working with the division and risk management to prevent the claims from being filed in the first place, in the sense of, I can remember an example, I'll wake up my good representative over here from Portland. When we both served on the Metro Council, we had a little bit of a problem for a while with claims. We always had problems with claims. But one of them was, people didn't recognize it, is that we operated certain performing arts and spectator facilities. Different risk or different crowd management services that were off that basically got contracts in those facilities at times were causing us some real problems because their training probably wasn't really adequate for what they were doing, and they was resulting potentially in litigation in terms of detaining individuals when they didn't really have a right to detain an individual, etc. So I'm just wondering how much activity you do basically if you see a problem within a division or a problem within a department. Yeah, working with risk management to try to make sure that those problems don't occur in the future.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, absolutely. And in fact, this afternoon, I know one of our attorneys is working with our labor section. We recently had a case arising out of the Department of Agriculture. It was an employment case, serious allegations of discrimination, gender bias, retaliation. And how I'll characterize it, we came in second, but we actually lost, there was a large verdict rendered. And there's a question in our mind about what does the case really mean when we look at what the instructions that the court gave to the jury. What does that mean for the state of Oregon? And so I know this afternoon the attorney is out working with our labor section to put together just that sort of, what sort of information do we provide to state agencies? Similarly, I guess if I were to look back and look at the dollars and cents in the areas where the state is most vulnerable today and the big ticket items, one of the biggest ticket items has to do with our employment and just how we are treating employees. And so we have, I know within the last 30 days, if I'm not mistaken, we've put on a CLE in conjunction with risk management that dealt with employment issues. How do managers deal with problem employees, or how do they deal with employees in general? So the answer to that is yes, we do. We work very closely. And the other thing that we do is that at the end of a case, to the extent that there are lessons to be learned,
then we will take those lessons to be learned and work with both risk management as well as the agency head to say, okay, what did we learn? Are we just going to, how many times are we going to try this case, or can we learn something from this? So I'd like to think that we do have an educational program that works very well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that response. And I do have to make an apology here to my good colleague from North Portland. I think we have tried to refrain from our normal, this is your humor, Madam Chair, we have tried to refrain from our normal attacks, and I will try to restrain myself. If he agrees.
That didn't cause any interest today.
Mr. Wood, you're doing just fine.
I saw money going into the piggy bank. I began to worry here.
We're going to catch you on CLE, but other than that, you're doing just fine.
And I believe the Attorney General is sitting back there keeping count.
It's the acronyms.
Let me say, seriously, I do appreciate your response about how there is a focus on lessons learned and lessons learned that can be applied through a training approach. And I'd be interested in knowing, when those kinds of training opportunities are made available, is participation mandatory? What's the incentive to get people there who, shall we say, need to be there?
Madam Chair, they're not mandatory that I'm aware of. I mean, I think that's a matter for management, is that, all right, how important is this? And so I think, but as far as the Department of Justice, they could offer the training. You can't lead the horse to water or something like that. So if we look at the next slide, we've got, as far as our performance measurements, we've got, what this is, what we looked at the first slide, and that was a combination of risk management and the Department of Justice. And one of the things I did not focus for you is that when we look at the cases where there is, in fact, a defendant's verdict, or a plaintiff's verdict, excuse me, what you found there is when we look at all of those statistics, it's only 0.25% of the claims that are made with risk management that eventually end up in a verdict for the plaintiff. And that in and of itself is not necessarily a win, because there are cases where you can sit down and you can have a disagreement over just what the dollars in the case, what the case is worth. So, for example, you can say, gee, we were wrong. The state was dead wrong on this. We admit we were wrong, and we want to pay you, and we want to pay you blank dollars. And the other side said, no, but I want my $1 billion. And so then the verdict comes in at less than what you were willing to pay them in the first instance. So the mere fact that that there is a verdict for the plaintiff does not necessarily mean it's an outright win. But we looked at that overall for risk management. This is just a focus on trial itself. And so what I will say at the end of the biennium or the end of a calendar year is I'll say to the staff and the various teams, I said, how did we do? How are we doing? And what this gives you a feel for is this is overall. And you can see here that over half the cases that come into trial, that we win straight out on motion. So one out of every two cases that is filed, it's dismissed with prejudice, and the state is the winner. The other side of it is you can see that about 40% of the cases, 39% of the cases, actually are settled. So what that shows you is that we are using alternative dispute resolution, that we are sitting down with the plaintiffs that file a lawsuit and say, all right, let's see if we can get to yes. What is it that you need? Let me tell you what the state's interest is in this particular case. And so once again, I think that that's a very good statistic when we look at the number of cases that we are actually able to reach resolution. That means only one out of every 10 cases that is filed end up in actually going to trial. And out of those, that we see that 7% of those cases we win, and only 1% results in a plaintiff's verdict.
Mr. Wood, can you wrap up in 5 minutes, or are you going to need a little bit more time?
I'll wrap up in 5 minutes, Madam Chair. The next slide, while this is not a performance measure, this is something that I take a quick look at, or I take a look at before we actually appear before the Ways and Means, and this just tells us what kind of workload, what are we seeing? And if you look at this, you'll see this is somewhat of a disturbing trend line that we're seeing a substantial increase in the number of cases that are appearing before us. And this is something that does give me pause. The good news is that when you look at the policy package, what we've said is that, look, with the current staffing we have and with the policy package that doesn't include attorneys, that we'd be able to meet the needs that we're finding as a result of this spike. What's causing this? Areas of significant growth. It was interesting as I sat here and listened to the statistics from Connie. You talked about sexual abuse. I'll tell you, it's something that really concerns me and should concern all of us for a number of reasons, but I look at it from a litigation point of view. We recently have 27 claims, 27 lawsuits arising out of just two priests who were employees of the Department of Corrections at McLaren. These are cases that arise out of the early 70s. That is a very disturbing trend. I'm not saying that whether the claims are legitimate or not. It's the fact that the claims can be made in and of themselves is a concern. And then it's very difficult if you think going back and trying to recreate what happened in 1973, it is extremely difficult. That's just at McLaren. When you pick up the paper today and you look at what's going on and with our foster with foster care and with our children, same sort of disturbing trend in my own mind. And so when I heard Connie talk about the statistics and the increase of like a 20% increase in reported sexual abuse, I thought, how is that going to translate to the Department of Justice and the defense? Because what we need to do, what we have to do, is we defend the foster parents. Now, not if they actually did it, but once you have an allegation that there's sexual abuse and we're unable to make that determination, we would end up defending those foster parents. So as I look in my crystal ball and look down the road, I see a disturbing trend and would suggest that line was going to continue to spike. Institutional claims, read the paper for the last month, read the headlines. We've talked about the Oregon State Hospital, we've talked about the Department of Corrections, we've talked about the Department of Human Services and Foster Children. I'm going to suggest to you that what we're going to see out of those articles, and it's not the articles, it's what is the facts underlying those articles, what we're going to see is litigation arising from that. Condemnation, transportation, the session before, we were able to appropriate substantial funds for the Department of Transportation for increased building. What we're told time and time again by right-of-way and construction, we're going to see a large increase in the number of cases. And then last but not least, Measure 37. If any of you have been to anything of Measure 37, while I'm sure you're being told about all of the uncertainties of Measure 37, is there one thing that's certain from Measure 37?
Litigation.
Litigation. Absolutely. Okay, so we do have a policy package 462, and as I emphasized to you, it's not about attorneys. It's about providing support staff to meet the needs. House Bill 3182, this is the reductions of $1.5 million. Howie, you'll have an opportunity to talk to you about that. The thing that I would emphasize to you, when you talk about trial and litigation, and you're going to find that we're no different than the other teams, 83% of our costs have to do with personnel. And so when we talk about $1.5 million cutback, what that means is you're cutting personnel. Fewer lawyers, I'm not sure what the answer to that is when we get these lawsuits that we don't have a choice in. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions or comments for Mr. Wood?
I just have a comment.
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair. And it's really challenging, and all of the issues that you raise of areas of significant growth, I would concur with you. And combining that with that, we have also this society that believes in suing for everything. And when you talked about foster care and human services, also involved in that, if anything goes wrong, the state then becomes the person or the lawsuit if those individuals are in our care and custody, not just foster homes, but our staff as well. And that's why I raised that issue of the professional errors and omissions coverage, because sometimes even our capacity doesn't have enough dollars to satisfy all of these claims that are out there against both individuals as well as the state. And it is growing.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Wood, you were the third batter up. You brought your teammates across home plate.
for today. We thank you very much for your presentation and, again, your thoroughness. And as I said to the rest, the other members of your team, we look forward to having a further conversation with you. But, again, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members. We are adjourned.
Good meeting.